This is the Read to Lead podcast, episode 485.
If I'm worried about what my neighbor who I get drinks with or my aunt or uncle think in making decisions about my career, I have a much greater chance of getting stuck because I reduce my possibilities. I reduce my options.
Ever felt like you're stuck in a rut with your job? Or maybe you or someone you know jumped into college because of family pressure, gathering loans for a degree you're not even sure you're into. It's even tougher when you feel like you're backed into a corner, unable to explore new career paths. Hi, I'm Jeff Brown. This is the Read to Lead podcast, and that's our topic we're diving into today. Read to Lead is a podcast dedicated to your personal and professional growth, where each and every week I sit down with the author of what is often a brand new book, and we dive into that book and their unique insights on a number of topics. Today's guest is someone I've run around in podcast circles for the last 9 or 10 years and has become a friend of mine over that time. His name is Brian Orr, and he's written a book called Unconformed, An Unbound and Unbridled Path to Unstuck Growth. Brian and I will talk about why today learning how to learn is more important than what you learn, the importance of understanding the differences between expectations and standards, especially for parents, the value of learning through experience versus what is most often the way things are taught today, convenience, and much, much more. I cannot begin to tell you how much value is contained inside Read to Lead Plus, a part of the Read to Lead community online at jeffbrown.me. But you don't have to take my word for it. Brian says, I love what you're doing with Read to Lead Plus. I watched your first guest expert training with Christina Curtis and thought it was excellent. I have her book now, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the year. Thanks, Brian. And with regard to our monthly challenges, Michael said this is a great idea for a challenge. He's talking about our June challenge around self-promotion. He says, I've noticed that my strengths change over time, and I haven't necessarily done a very recent assessment of what my current superpowers are. Excited for the month. That's just the tip of the iceberg of the kind of feedback we're getting from members inside the Read to Lead community and from specifically Read to Lead Plus members. As a Plus member, you get access to a new business book summary every week, access to a monthly guest expert training, either live or you can watch the replay, access to a monthly Ask Me Anything led by me, access to monthly challenges, networking opportunities, and a chance to be spotlighted in front of the entire community of over 400 people. And all of that is just $9 a month, and you can even try it out free for 2 weeks. Just go to jeffbrown.me right now. Take advantage of that 2-week trial. Make sure you like it. And if you do, again, it's just $9 a month after that. jeffbrown.me for all the details. Brian Orr is a business owner and father of 10 who has spent a lifetime embracing the challenges of entrepreneurship, family, and the skilled trades. As a speaker, writer, and mentor, he regularly discusses his experiences and insights about making a family business thrive in the modern world. He's also an advocate for the skilled trades as an alternative to the traditional college path. His new book is called Unconformed, An Unbound and Unbridled Path to Unstuck Growth. Well, Brian, welcome officially to the podcast. I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad you let me know you had a book coming out because I loved it, and I'm really proud of what you've done. I've known you for a few years, and had a chance to see some of that growth, I guess. And to me, this is a treat having you on. I'm just really excited for you.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. I've been a fan of yours for many years, all the way back to the first podcast movement, and I've listened to your show for a long time. So it's really exciting and great to be here.
I'm curious to know if you know New York Times bestselling author Dan Miller by chance.
Yeah, I don't know Dan personally, but absolutely been in the same circles and definitely appreciated him over the years. Great guy.
If you've not officially met him, I need to introduce the two of you, because as I read your book, I kept thinking over and over and over about Dan and how Dan would just be loving this and eating this up. It's just right up his alley. And we'll get more into later why that is. But he's definitely somebody whose radar you need to be on if you're not already. Well, let me first kind of dive into talking about sort of your unconventional path through school to an eventual career, and how you believe the options that your family gave you, your father in particular, but by extension, your grandfather and your uncle, that, that more young people need to be exposed to, frankly.
Yeah, it was very unconventional. And you know, it's so funny when people ask you questions about your life. And now when you have to write a book about your life, there's so many things you take for granted, like that. Oh, no, I mean, I'm sure everybody has that experience, right? And as I've analyzed it and had these conversations, because, again, this isn't the sort of thing you talk about every day, you realize how unique my upbringing was. And so, you know, from a very young age, being exposed to the skilled trades and a lot of conversations with my dad, who was very interested in the work that he did as an electrician when I was young and would talk to me about theory. And I had the kind of mind where I was always very curious. I loved science and I loved things like that, but it was more traditional. You know, I had a good solid elementary education where I was introduced to all the same things everyone else was, though I was homeschooled. But I was always very curious. And my dad was always have those conversations, but then in working with my grandfather and literally working even at a young age, that's a key thing there. My grandpa, I talk a lot about him in the book. He's not the type of person who's a traditional educator. You know, he didn't sit me down on his knee and go from A to Z through a topic. We would just dive in and do things together. And because he ran an aircraft salvage yard when I was a kid, so actually tearing apart old airplanes and traveling around the country with him, meeting new people and taking apart airplanes and working with him at an air show, I got to just experience a lot of things. And that at the time, and even kind of as I was working and in my working career, I never understood the connection between that experiences or all those experiences, those broad experiences, and some of the things that just came easy to me that other people didn't necessarily feel, especially as it related to just the confidence to take on things. That's a question that I've always gotten from people. It's like, well, what, and maybe implicit in that is it maybe an insult almost, like, but what makes you think you can do that? You know, who gave you the right to take on this challenge or to do this particular thing? And in exploring these ideas and thinking about childhood education and the trades and careers and being unstuck, I've never felt stuck. I can attribute that to those early educational experiences that maybe didn't feel like education to me at the time, but in retrospect, clearly were.
Yeah, I would imagine hanging around at an air show wouldn't feel like education or school much at all. That sounds like a whole heck of a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was. It was.
Especially as a young boy. And you graduated high school at an early age, too. And some might think, well, gosh, this kid's super smart. He didn't go to college. He didn't just jump right in and you know, become a lawyer or a doctor. Why not?
Yeah. And it's funny because, again, when you're and you know, if you kind of think back to when you're young and how the young mind works, hindsight may be 20/20. But unless you take the time to sort of analyze it, you don't see it. And that's what I've done here to kind of analyze where was my head at that time, or where was the heads of the people around me at, who didn't point me to college as the only option. We certainly had all those discussions. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I realized was, and I guess first let's back up and just address the why I graduated when I was 16. I didn't graduate when I was 16 because I was like a genius. It was just that I was homeschooled. And when I was young, especially in the elementary grades, things were just popping. They were coming really easily and to me. And so my mom, as she was teaching me, and my dad, they just didn't hold me back. So as I was capable of learning, they would just let me keep progressing through the curriculum and through the learning experience. And so I just got ahead. I got a couple grades ahead, and then I hit a period. And I think this is important for people to hear who maybe have bright kids or kids who it really comes easy for a while. I hit a period when I was 11 or 12 where it stopped being that way. Like it actually, it wasn't easy for me. And I think it's, you know, you start to change. I think your brain gets flooded with all these chemicals and it wasn't easy for a little bit. And then it got easier again, but it wasn't this straight linear path of like brilliance. It was a bumpy road, but when I hit the point where I'm 16 and I'm done with high school, and that conversation that I had with my father that I still specifically remember where we were sitting and the entire thing was very formative for me, because as a college educated guy himself and somebody who had also worked in the trades, his perspective was super unique. And it was that you don't necessarily have to start with college. You can start by developing hard skills that you can actually apply no matter where you go. And then you always have that. And that's been his perspective that he shared with me and my siblings and a lot of other people. And while it isn't necessarily the only way, it was a way that worked really well for me. Because the idea of now going into a structured educational environment and not being able to experience the tactile real world experiences that I was so used to, having worked with my grandpa and worked with my uncle and all these things, that just didn't seem like what I wanted. I just, the idea of going and spending a lot of my time in a classroom doing coursework or in studying a book, as much as I love those things, and I really do, I still do. I love to read. I mean, heck, I'm on one of my favorite podcasts, the Read to Lead podcast. I love that stuff. But the idea of taking away that really, you know, being able to solve real problems with my hands wasn't something I wanted to do. And so I made the decision to go into trade school. And for me, that I believe was the right choice.
That trajectory reminds me so much. You talked about school and coming easy and then it not. I so identify with that. That happened for me as I was a freshman in high school, right when the grades start counting for college is when I began to struggle. Went to college right out of high school, lasted a couple of years and dropped out for 3 years. That's when I fell into doing radio. Then eventually went back and got a degree. I thought it might be helpful to have just a general business degree. But I had no business being in college at 18. I just was not ready. And I won't say those 2 years were what my parents might say the money was wasted, but I won't say those those 2 years were ultimately wasted. But I so wish I would have done it a lot differently than I did. That's for sure. Expound on what you mean when you say that learning how to learn is more important than what you learn.
Yeah. And first off, I want to say, I don't know that this was always true. I know where we're at today. I think there was a time when information was not readily available. You couldn't just grab the little computer in your pocket and find a resource that you needed. And so I think the accumulation of knowledge maybe was more valuable in a wide range of careers years and years ago. But nowadays, we do have access to all of these things. And so when you see in a lot of cases, this comes up when I'm dealing with other educators. So in my space of HVAC, I do a lot of training. And so I'll interact with older educators and they really become very focused on that accumulation of knowledge. And then you pull out an app and you're like, but it's just right there. You know, I have a calculator that I can rely on that does this. And kind of going back to the thing all of our teachers told us when we were in elementary school and you tried to use a calculator, they would say some version of, well, you're not always going to have a calculator. It's like, well, now we kind of do, right? And so that doesn't mean that you don't need to know how to do math, especially in your elementary education. I'm definitely not saying you don't need to understand first principles, because you do. But first principles, those basics are what help you learn how to learn. But then from there, you become, we talk a lot about in the book about autodidact, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that, but somebody who knows how to go out and find what it is that you need when you need it. That just-in-time education model is really what our society is built on now. It's how we can move so quickly and so nimbly. And those skills of being able to learn what you need to learn when you need to learn it translate directly to careers. So not only is it fun for somebody like me, at least, to always be learning and to always be going to resources, using those first principles, those basic concepts to be able to interpret new resources, but it's really what the workforce demands in most cases today.
Now it's not calculators so much as it is, I think, artificial intelligence.
Yeah, for sure.
Educators are shaking their fists at.
Right.
So we're going to talk a lot more about young people, and those listening who have kids are certainly going to be perking up to that discussion. But also there's that issue of, well, I'm already in the workforce. What's the message in this book for me? Maybe I have kids, maybe I don't.
It is a challenge when you read the book, because I do bounce back and forth between those two topics quite a bit. But I also think that a big thing that works in terms of thinking about how you can get unstuck is connecting with that younger version of yourself. You know, like going back and kind of unpacking the journey that you've been on can help you understand maybe why you're in a position where you feel stuck now. And one of the kind of fundamental things that I address in the book is this idea that being stuck or unstuck has absolutely nothing to do with a piece of paper. And I'm not down. When I say piece of paper, a lot of people hear that as me saying that I'm speaking ill of their degree or saying that that's not valuable. And I absolutely think it is. And I address that in the book. I think it's great when people show dedication and learn something and actually go through and receive a degree in something. But what we do know for sure is that once that you have that in hand, that's really just the starting point. And recognizing that pursuing curiosity and being open to take full responsibility for the rest of your journey is what makes all the difference. And that goes back to when you're a kid, shotgunning before you laser, being willing to just try and experience a lot of things and not being afraid to do that, not thinking that you're somehow going to get stuck by trying something new or doing something that maybe you traditionally didn't think was so prestigious. Mm-hmm. A lot of times we limit ourselves when we're looking at prestige or we're looking at things that seem fun to talk about at a cocktail party. But a lot of times the greater opportunities or things that you may be rewarded by are things that maybe you didn't even know existed, and you're not going to find them unless you're willing to move laterally and open your mind to different possibilities, which is, you know, that's fairly broad and fairly woo-woo, but this comes up a lot. I podcast about HVAC, and I talked about this at a podcasting conference several years ago, where when people ask what I podcast about now and I say HVACR education, you know, they're kind of like, oh, okay, you know, that's okay, that's nice. You know, that's not exciting to people to hear about. But the reality is that there are hundreds of thousands of people throughout the world who consume the content that I create, and it's super rewarding. It's really fun to do that. But if I'm worried about what my neighbor who I get drinks with, or my aunt or uncle think in making decisions about my career, I have a much greater chance of getting stuck because I reduce my possibilities. I reduce my options.
And if I'm not mistaken, part of your story with that podcast includes having a few employees find you through that podcast, through listening to your show, right?
Oh, yeah, quite a few. I mean, we've grown from three of us in my business to about 270 today. Mm-hmm. And a good portion of the team that we now have either heard about me from the podcast or were drawn to the organization once they found out about it in some way. So it helps with both retention and with attracting employees. So there's a lot of different things that you would never expect when you're willing to pursue the weird and the different, when you're willing to explore a lot of different possibilities and not limit yourself because it doesn't sound like it's something that would be rewarding.
You positioned yourself as a leader in your space, as an expert in your space. You, I'm sure, were one of the few in the HVAC space with a podcast, right? And so that prompted you or caused you to stand out to so many. I remember doing a presentation on a virtual summit, and the presentation was business owners, and the idea was convincing business owners to start a podcast and why they needed to. And I remember using your podcast and a bit of your story as one of the examples of what can happen when you start a podcast related to your industry and your business. Talk a bit about the difference that parents especially need to understand, and I loved how you laid this out in the book, between expectations and standards. How are these different, and why is it so important to understand that difference?
So huge. It's one of the things that I think about most and also fail in most as a parent. So it's really important when I'm talking to my team, you know, because I've given them the book and when I hand it to them, I always say, okay, just to be clear here, I'm not saying these things in this book saying that I'm perfect at these things. These are all works in progress for me. But one thing that I found about expectations and standards, and you can actually, as you hear those words, I would encourage you to kind of think about that. Mm. Somebody who is maybe in leadership over you, if they have high standards or if they have high expectations, how do those things feel different? Hmm. Expectations are personal, and they are connected to both potentially criticism and disappointment. If somebody doesn't meet your expectations, then the only thing you can do is be disappointed, right? That's the natural extension of that. Whereas if somebody doesn't meet the standard, well, you're just all still working towards the standard. The standard is about us. It's something that we are all working to achieve and probably never fully will, right? Mm-hmm. We're all constantly driving towards this. If you imagine kind of looking out in the distance and you're all walking towards a point, that's what a standard is. It's this thing that we're all working towards and walking towards. And I'm holding myself to it, and you're holding me to it, and I'm holding you to it. And we have this agreement, if you will. Whereas an expectation is something that you put on somebody else. And I think we all know, you know, it's interesting if we think about our parents, whether we had good parents or difficult parents, whether the situations were easy or challenging, we all can look back and think about times when we had expectations placed on us. And our reaction to those expectations is very rarely healthy. It may have achieved an outcome in terms of our behavior that people wanted, but how we internalize it and how we process that was almost never healthy. Mm. Versus saying our standard here is that you are a person who treats other people the way you want to be treated. You know, things like the golden rule, things like love your neighbor as yourself, things like you treat people with respect, regardless of their background or creed, you know, things like that. Those are all standards, and they tend to be bigger, and they tend to be something that we're all held to, versus things like careers with kids where expectations can creep in really quick. Like, you're going to college because I didn't get a chance to go to college and you're going to have the life I never had. Right. Yeah. It's well-meaning. It's not, there's nothing, you know, people aren't doing that because there's something wrong or broken in them. They do it because it's very natural to do that. And it's very natural to feel that way. But that pressure very rarely leads to great outcomes with kids versus saying, here's the thing we're all walking towards. Now let's figure out what that means for you. And let's individualize what this, how this standard applies to your journey.
You know, I identify with that as well. My father, especially, and this was good in so many ways. He's not with us anymore, but he was very much about providing things for us that he never had. He had an eighth grade education, grew up very poor, you know, helping his father on his tobacco farm, spent his entire life as a manual laborer, and just, you know, bought me my first car, wanted to make sure I went to college, all those sorts of things. And this is where I think you and Dan really align and why I mentioned him earlier. I remember reading something Dan wrote regarding seeing this marquee on a high school that said, you know, 94% college placement or something like that. The high school was touting the percentage of students who'd graduated who were going to go to college. And Dan's response to that was, how sad, you know, right. that we think everybody, the closer we can get to 100%, sending everybody on the same path, the better we've done. How sad. That is something I think the two of you agree on.
But the same could be true of the other thing. Like if I said, this school had a placard that said 94% are placed in the trades, I'd be like, how sad, right? Mm-hmm. Because anything where you try to distill these really big, nuanced life experiences into a single data metric like that, I just think it's unhealthy. It isn't to say that you can't be qualitative to some degree or you can't put metrics behind things, but it's never just one thing. What do we really want for ourselves? What do we really want for our kids? What do we really want for society? Freedom's pretty high on that list, right? The options and possibilities and being able to tailor a life based on your own inclinations and desires and curiosities. And that's where when we try to shoehorn kids or any young people or anyone really into this idea that you have to do college or you have to do this or you have to do that, it's very rarely healthy.
Mm. You mentioned autodidacts. Talk about what that is and how parents can go about raising more of them, basically.
Yeah, it's interesting. The first time I ever heard that word was from Aisha Tyler at Podcast Movement 2015. And when I first heard that word, I was like, man, that's a complicated word. But the way she described it was, she said, I'm an autodidact. That means I'm a crazy person. and I definitely relate to that, right? And because within society, you always are going to get that pushback when you choose to be autodidactic, because people always want permission. We all want it. If we're going to do something, we want somebody to say, yeah, you are permitted to do it. And then once we do it, we want them to say, and you did it right. You did the right thing the right way. Mm. Whereas autodidacts recognize that there is very rarely somebody who can really give you permission, honestly. And very rarely is there only one right way of doing it. Mm. So autodidacts fundamentally are self-learners. They're lifelong learners. It does not mean that you don't learn from other people, but it does mean that the journey or path that you take is self-guided. You're not going to just accept a syllabus and say, okay, I went from here to here. I get my degree. Now I know what I'm doing. Doesn't mean that you couldn't do that. But in addition to that, you're always going to be pursuing your interests. You're always going to be kind of looking around that next corner. A lot of times, I think it does go along with people who are on the ADHD spectrum of some sort. And I certainly am because there is this, you know, squirrel effect. And I talk about that in the book, too. You do have to apply discipline to autodidactism to actually accomplish things that you want to accomplish. But that impulse to say, no, I can't because I don't have permission. No, I can't because I didn't take a course. I don't have a degree. No, I can't because nobody has told me that I'm good enough, strong enough, fast enough. And gosh darn it, people like me. You know, like that's something that an autodidact, whether you're confident or not, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert, you don't wait for those things. You just forge ahead and you pursue those curiosities and pursue that lifelong education yourself.
And something too that lifelong learners, I think, struggle with, I know this is something that I am always trying to be careful of, is what I call, I think you call it something different, slightly different in the book, but I think it means the same thing, is the illusion of knowledge, is the thinking that just because you've consumed a bunch of content on a particular topic now means you know a lot about it. When you're suddenly put on the spot or asked to explain it, that might be a different issue altogether.
Right. And that's actually part of that sort of autodidactic stack, or even if you want to just think that lifelong learning stack of being able to explain or educate others on a topic. The term that I cover in the book, and it's a well-studied concept, is the illusion of explanatory depth. It's a really fancy way of saying that you really think you understand something until you're forced to explain it in detail. And the example that was studied in detail was asking people how well they understand zippers. And so people, if you ask them, hey, do you understand zippers? Oh, yeah, on a scale of 1 to 10, man, I'm a 9. I understand a zipper. And what they mean is they know how to zip their pants up and down, right? What they don't mean is that I actually have the ability to describe how it works. Because when you start to think about it, it's like, huh, I guess I really don't know how that works. It's kind of weird, right? Yeah. And that's true of so many things. I mean, a really common modern example is if you ask kids if they know how to use an iPhone. Yes, they know how to use an iPhone because you can watch them do it, right? They scroll through whatever. Now, if you say, do you know how an iPhone works? They will say, yes, I understand how an iPhone works, but they do not at all understand how an iPhone works. They don't understand cell signals. They don't understand the batteries. They don't understand everything that goes into that device. But that's also true of adults. You see that time and time again. And that's where autodidactism can actually allow you to dive deeper in that knowledge or that perception of what you don't understand is a lot of times that driving factor towards being truly autodidactic, to actually being a self-learner, is you dive into something and you say, huh, I realize I don't know how zippers work. And then you dive down the rabbit hole and actually learn how they work. Now, that may not be so valuable in the case of zippers, but in the case of cell phones, absolutely would be, right? If you decide, hey, you know, I'm actually really curious about this. How does this work? And you go on this autodidactic journey and then you start taking apart some phones. And next thing you know, you actually understand how this works. That could very well be a career skill. And it's people's impulse to say, well, I can't do that, that I think limits the possibilities of what they can achieve.
You know, I like to think that that's been my attitude in a lot of ways. I remember when I was working in radio, I started a side business, and it was a great, turned out to be, in hindsight, a great thing to do, because a few years later, I would lose that job and need to fall back on that side business. But I was fascinated, related to smartphones, with mobile apps. And so I decided I was going to dive into, well, how do you do that? How does a mobile app come to be? And that led to me offering mobile apps as a service to local businesses in our area who at the time thought, well, that's not a space I can be in because I don't have the money for that. I can't possibly afford to have something like that built or have a mobile app for my business. And so that was something that I did for 4 or 5 years. I encourage people to do that sort of thing all the time. Many are afraid because they're like, well, what's my employer going to think? Or they think I'm moonlighting or this or that. I didn't worry about that, frankly. I'm not suggesting that as advice. I just did it and thought, well, if they don't like it or they find out about it, I'm sure I'll hear about it. But I'm not going to worry about that because I'm not doing this on their time. I'm doing this on my time. And as far as I'm concerned, that's none of their business.
Yeah. I mean, and it's so true. And that ties into a lot of different topics. But one of my friends, Nick Loper, from the Side Hustle Show, you know, he's that guy. You know, that's how he started out, is, you know, working a traditional job, super smart, super intelligent guy, and then just started pursuing some little side hustles. And then that became what for him is not only a very successful business, but also helping a lot of other people do the same thing. That's exactly what I'm talking about. And when you think about people who are already maybe mid-career or even getting later in their career, there's absolutely nothing that prevents you from applying these same principles. But just recognizing the seed is curiosity and an ability to perceive when you don't really understand something that might be helpful to understand. But the thing that prevents you is just fear. And it's actually surprisingly more often social fear than anything else. And that's what I dive into a lot. There's a lot of social pressures that want to keep people in their lanes. They're like, hey, do HVAC, HVAC boy, do radio, radio boy. You know, that's what you do. You don't belong over here. Yeah. And that's not good for us to put on our kids. It's not good for us to put on ourselves. If you shotgun and you get curious about things, you're going to notice pretty quickly whether or not there's something in it for you, whether or not this actually has legs and you can run with it. And if not, give it up, move on to the next thing. That's fine. But it's absolutely possible that it may be something that becomes a huge part of your life, like podcasting was for me. I mean, before we started this, we were nerding out on gear and the stuff that we used to do. And because we talked about this back in the day, And that's what led to not only possibilities in terms of podcasting and what I've created there, but also in terms of public speaking, getting comfortable talking, getting comfortable with your own voice, getting comfortable with, you know, all those things, getting comfortable with editing. I learned a lot of that from you. Those are things that now translate into a wide array of other possibilities that are now opened up, because when the opportunity arose and I was interested in it, I didn't say, well, but who can give me authorization? You know, I wasn't looking around for social proof before I went ahead and just pursued what I was interested in.
You know, and you mentioned in the book not being good at one time at small talk. And I remember first meeting you. Well, actually, you were quick to remind me that I forgot the time that I first met you, because the second time I met you, I thought it was the first time I met you, but it was not. But I remember the shy guy, this very, you know, quiet person, it seemed to me at the time. And then reading in the book about these different conferences you've spoken at and panels you've been on, I'm like, you go, man. You're like out there. You've worked on, you know, 99% Invisible podcast and This American Life podcast. And I mean, it's just amazing all the things that you have done without worrying about, you know, where you quote, like you said, you should be, and worrying about people saying or in your own head thinking, I have no business doing this. You just do it.
Yeah. And that certainly doesn't mean that there isn't a continuous state of imposter syndrome, like this feeling of, yeah, I mean, you know, maybe I'm a poser. But then you start to realize that's what everybody experiences. Mm. And that recognition that I'm not even going to live up to my own standards when I do this. That goes in the book. I quote Ira Glass and his whole kind of talk on the tension between taste and quality work, and how it really requires you really need to have good taste in order to start in the first place. But that same good taste is what prevents you from being happy about the work that you're producing, right? Which makes you feel really bad sometimes about what it is that you're doing. And a lot of people think that it's confidence or maybe even ego that drive people forward who do this. But I can tell you that's not the case. There are extroverts who practice this stuff. There are introverts. There are people who are very comfortable in social situations, and there are super awkward folks. There are people with a lot of natural confidence and those with very little natural confidence who can be autodidacts and who can kind of follow the things that I discuss in this book. And that's true if you just look at the different people who I point out. There's a wide sliver of humanity that participate in this way of being unstuck, this way of being unconformed. But the central belief system that allows you to do it is that it's okay, right? It's okay if I feel uncomfortable. It's okay if my work isn't perfect. It's okay if I don't have approval and authorization. It's okay if I don't have people constantly telling me that I'm good enough. That those tensions that we feel, some of us are going to feel them more. Some people are going to forge ahead and making a mistake isn't going to bother them. If you're like me and you're pretty neurotic, when I make a mistake or when I, you know, I'm not happy with what I produce, it bothers me pretty deeply. But that doesn't prevent me and many others from moving forward and taking that next step and continuing down that path. You don't let the resistance stop you from moving forward.
There are a lot of folks who listen to the show who are in the education space, whether that's traditional, you know, K-12 or a college education or some other facet. Something you point out that I think is worth mentioning in the book is, and you touched on it briefly earlier, and I'd love for you to expound on it a bit, is this difference between learning through experience versus the route typically taken by our educational system, which is a more convenient route.
Yeah, it's always more convenient to talk than it is to do any other type of education, right? This is rich coming from me, teaching HVAC through a podcast, right? I get it. Like there's absolutely value in lecture type format and in people who are really good verbal educators. Absolutely huge value. But what I state in the book and what I believe deeply, because I've experienced it both in childhood education and in adult education, is that people have to have a mental model that supports the words that are being said. And the fastest way to generate a mental model for most people is to have a tactile experience. And so it's flipping education on its head, where I would much rather, if I'm going to teach, you know, somebody about an air conditioning compressor, I would much rather have them tear apart an air conditioning compressor and see what it looks like before they understand what it does. And that's weird to a lot of people. It's like, well, why wouldn't you, don't you need to understand it first? Well, otherwise those words have no form, have no tree to hang on, so to speak. All of those words have to have some sort of backbone. Now, you can use other metaphors and similes that can help get people there. You can say a compressor is like this or like that, or the example I use is electricity. You know, electricity is like water flowing through the pipe. That's great, especially for things that you can never see. But if you have the opportunity to have a tactile experience to start that kind of understanding, I think it's really, really helpful. Now, adults who have had a lot of experiences in their life, they may not need to have that because they already have a lot of things they can draw from, which makes metaphor and simile a little bit easier. But we're dealing with a generation now of kids who don't have those same experiences, who did not change the oil in the car with their dads, who do not know how to change their tire. And so there's a lot of the world that is a gigantic mystery to them. You know, how the milk actually gets on the shelf in the grocery store to a lot of kids is a complete mystery. And so it's much better to give them an experience of a cow and maybe even milking a cow by hand, right? That gives you so much more rich of an experience. And for people like me, I received a lot of that naturally just by being a kid who did a lot of things. But for people who are looking for that next opportunity or that next possibility, I don't think it changes. It's the same way if you really wanted to learn Spanish, your best bet would be to go to a Spanish-speaking country for a couple weeks and speak Spanish. You know, sure, maybe you'd learn a few words before you'd go, but you'd be terrible when you were applying it at first. But that immersion would be the driver that would force you to actually learn it. And we know this. We know that without context, education doesn't stick. How many of us have learned things like, you know, trigonometry or algebra 2 when we were in high school, and we don't maintain any of that because we don't practice it? Whereas basic arithmetic and reading, we keep. Why? Because we practice it every day, right? And those things, I think we know that intuitively. But when we actually are put in a position to teach, it's so hard to do it because we're often afraid of risk and inconvenience and all those sorts of things. And rather than embracing the fact that, you know, a bloody nose isn't the end of the world, or having something be challenging to go out to that field trip, that is something that's hard to coordinate, especially in public education. But it is worth it. And as a society, I think we've gone the wrong direction in both ways, where more and more, and anybody who's in the trades or anybody who's had anyone work on their home in the last 10 years have noticed this, the skills and the basic knowledge that people are coming out of high school with is much less than it used to be. And that's something that our society is going to bear the consequences of if we don't turn it around, which coincidentally is interesting because the people who have been the biggest supporters of my book, there's four people who I have in mind, are four of the most highly college educated people that I know. I mean, Ryan Gorman, who wrote my foreword, you know, he's a Wharton Business School graduate, brilliant guy, highly educated. Kimberly Llewellyn, an engineer, one of the smartest people I know and very highly educated. The lady who helped me edit the book is actually a college professor. So all of these folks both see the benefit of higher education, as do I, but recognize the challenges that society faces if we don't start with experience first, at least in some way.
And going back to the trades for a second, and you touch on this in the book, because we're so funneling our young people to college, we don't have quote unquote quality individuals or as many quality individuals as we would like in the trades. And the demand is outweighing the supply. And I see that affecting the costs of the things that we need, that HVAC repair person or what have you. What's your experience tell you there?
Yeah, it's two different pieces to this. So you identified one half, which is that when we take our smart kids in the system and we say, hey, you're smart, go to college, right? First of all, I don't think that serves them because there's a lot of smart kids who would rather work with their hands than do more book work, right? So that's the first thing. But also that does kind of dilute the infrastructure backbone of our country, which again, we are very much a knowledge and services-based economy, but that only goes so far, right? We still need to make things. We still need to fix things. We still need to install machines. We still need to build buildings. Those are all those things. So yes, that definitely dilutes the workforce. But then the other side is that there are a lot of people who just, they're not good at traditional education. That doesn't mean they're not smart. We all know this. Those of you who are listening to this, you probably know a young person or you know somebody in your life who is brilliant in terms of what they're able to apply, but they just don't work in the traditional educational paradigm. That's not where they should be. But they end up going out into this workplace where there's a lot of disrespect. And so if you don't, and I think something that we really don't consider is the effect that being disrespected, being fundamentally disrespected by society, what impact that has on you as a person. So I think it's both ways. I think sometimes we don't have as many good people in the trade, but just as much, if not more, people end up in the trades and have to bear disrespect and kind of reductive thinking towards what their contributions are to society. And that results in a lot of mental health challenges and a lot of physical breakdown that leads to discontent, frustration, and a lot of those issues. I see a massive, massive mental health and substance abuse issue in the trades. And I think it has as much to do with the fact that the trades did that to people because of some of those lack of respect and those societal pressures, and even just expectations of how much they should work. I mean, your average tradesman nowadays is working 50, 60, 70 hours a week in a lot of cases just to try to keep up with the burden. And the way that society talks to those people is just kind of like, well, hey, you didn't show up on time. What's your problem? You know, like what you need to do what you're, you know, why aren't you doing what you're supposed to do here? And by the way, you're charging me too much and I'm unhappy about that, right? That's the experience that a lot of tradespeople and skilled craftsmen have throughout our country. Same thing is true of teachers. Same thing is true of law enforcement. So I'm not just saying the trades, but people are really like, I don't want to do this anymore. This isn't fun. This isn't the joke I always say is when I give talks and I talk about the pressures in the trades, you know, I always at some point just say, you know, I wonder why I didn't do insurance as a business. That sounds better. You know, like, because you see your neighbors who do professional services and you start to think, well, why am I doing this anymore? This is so much pressure, so much stress. So I really do think it's both.
I want to ask you too about mentorships and apprenticeships and how you see those, how you value them, and also what's different with private mentorships. That's a phrase I hadn't heard before.
Yeah. So it's the same sort of thing applied, the same sort of thing I'm talking about, the education system now applied to the on the job or the hands-on part. So it's funny. I consistently give talks at homeschool conventions because I was homeschooled. I homeschool my kids. So those are sort of my people about mentorships and apprenticeship and all this. And afterwards, they'll inevitably come up to me and there'll be some version of, yeah, but how does this work? Like, how do I get the certification? What is the syllabus? How do I go from A to Z in this? And it's so funny because we talk about it as if we need to take apprenticeship and make it exactly like the college educational experience. You know what I mean? It's kind of humorous to me that we always try to distill things down to a system. Now, does a system need to exist? Absolutely. And those systems do exist. There are these structured apprenticeships through the Department of Labor. Every state has some form of interaction with either the federal government or their own programs. So these things exist. But the downside is a lot of times it doesn't work for everything that there is. And in many cases, the greatest opportunity to really be apprenticed or to be mentored is with smaller companies where you get to work with that sort of expert yourself. Right. So if you're going into a really large organization, you know, and around here, it's Disney, for example, you know, they're going to have these sorts of programs and it's going to be a good experience, but it's not going to be the same experience as if you want to be you want to learn how to make knives or do blacksmithing, actually working with somebody who's an independent blacksmith, making high quality tools and working with them in their shop. Right. And that person likely isn't going to fit into the traditional model of apprenticeship or mentorship, but that's still absolutely what is going on, right? And I think in a lot of cases, what we have the opportunity to do as a society is to support the smaller creatives, the smaller organizations, the smaller tradespeople, smaller craftspeople with some very basic structures of how to do what it is that they do and make mentorship and apprenticeship part of that, which is something that I'm actively doing in the HVAC trade and I'm seeing other people do it. But what I don't want people to do is wait for the system to come around that's going to make this perfect. In the same way that a lot of people go to college and they know that the college system isn't perfect, right? There's things about it that are great and there's things about it that aren't great, but we still do it because it's what's there. What's there right now is a lot of skilled people who could really use a hand and would love to teach. And a lot of people would call that on-the-job training. Well, how's that different than on-the-job training? Well, it's not that much different other than the mindset. Because the mindset in terms of mentorship and apprenticeship is about developing the person, not about having somebody hand you tools. It's not about having a helper. It's about training somebody up and providing them the skills and knowledge that they need to be competent.
Love this discussion. What haven't I asked you, Brian, from the book that maybe you wished I had or want to make sure that people know about?
So I have a chapter in the book that's about, and it's kind of tongue in cheek, about the importance of repetition, the importance of establishing mastery. And people have talked about this so many times. There's so many books about this concept, But it's really important because when I talk about this idea of shotgunning before you laser, of having a wide range of broad experiences, sometimes that can sound very distracted and very kind of all over the place. And that's not at all what I'm suggesting. I'm very much suggesting that you're experiencing different things while you're still hammering the nail all the way in. I don't know who I heard that concept from, but I really like it, is that you need to have something that you're really hammering that nail all the way in. And maybe sometimes it might be a few somethings, but it can't be too many, right? Mm. But while you're doing that, you can also be learning and experiencing other things so you can figure out what your next nail might be. Mm. But what I'm absolutely wanting to get across, especially to younger people, is this concept that Mike Rowe talks about a lot, Mike Rowe from Dirty Jobs, which is that we should probably not chase our passion because passion is very fickle, but we absolutely do need to bring our passion with us wherever we go. And why that matters is a lot of people will ask that question. It's one of the most common questions I get is, well, how do I know what my passion is? How do I know what my thing is that I'm going to do? And the answer is that you may never know fully. You know what it is for you right now. And so that's true if you're 10 years old or if you're 50 years old. You've got this thing right now that's your main thing, right? And that's good. So you need to get a lot of reps on that. You need to get really good at that and dive into that and bring a lot of passion to bear in that. But also be willing to recognize that that is very likely going to change. And that's a good thing. I mean, that kind of goes back to the book, Who Moved My Cheese? You know, it's like sometimes that cheese is going to disappear and we cannot view that as a bad thing. Think about, wagon makers back in the olden days. You know, that was a really necessary thing, making wagon wheels and wagons. And then all of a sudden that business went away, or maybe not all of a sudden, but over time. And so you got to move on to that next thing, and embracing that's really important. But while you are making wagon wheels, drive that nail all the way in. Stick with that thing. Make it something that is really important to you and that you understand deeply. Because I don't want people to give the idea that what I'm saying is that you rush all over the place, taking on every new opportunity and overwhelming yourself. That is not at all what is effective. And for me, driving that nail in has been HVACR. That's what I've done for most of my life. And that's been very rewarding. But podcasting and video production and public speaking and all these other things have come along, which now are a huge part of my life and something that I really care about. But they're still not the main nail, right? They're still not the main thing that's driving me forward.
And writing a book and becoming an author.
Right. Having 10 kids. Yeah. All that stuff.
How does he find the time? I don't know.
Yeah.
Brian, over the course of your career, you mentioned being a lifelong learner and a lover of books. So this may be a difficult question to answer. If you had to pick one or two books that just stand out as being ones that had a huge impact on you, and maybe they're ones that you recommend to other people for that reason, what would those books be?
Yeah. Books to me are in so many different categories that it's hard for me to do that. But I'll just name the two that popped to my head that I do recommend the most. The first one is Good to Great. And that is a business book. And obviously it's an easy one. And everybody has, so many people have benefited from that book. But for me, it came at a time in my business life that it was so formative and has really just transformed how I think about what my role is as a leader of an organization. And so much of that is around my demeanor, how I interact with people, but really about how I choose where people end up. So that's been huge, how they're placed within the organization. Another one is Anti-Fragile. And Anti-Fragile for me is, it doesn't directly connect with so many of the things in my book, but in sort of esoteric ways, it really does. This recognition that disorder is something that we're all going to face, and being able to improve when disorder arises, taking those opportunities to make that next step forward is huge and has been a really big part of my career, because eventually so many things that I have done that haven't been the main nail have failed. Meaning at some point I give up on it, I'm not doing it anymore, and being okay with that, being able to see that as part of that sort of anti-fragile journey.
Yeah. And I looked down as you were talking, because over here somewhere is Anti-Fragile, the book I'm in the middle of reading. I haven't finished it yet, but
it's a long one. It's got a lot of words, but it's a good central message.
I do a cohort called Note Making Mastery, currently in its fifth iteration, started a year ago. And we walk students through collecting knowledge. There's four pillars: collect, connect, crystallize, create. Tools to use to collect knowledge simply and easily, and the importance of a central hub for everything that you're wanting to collect. Being able to connect new ideas to existing ideas. The importance of then crystallizing that information, adding your own two cents, if you will. And then using those three pillars as building blocks to create. What's your system? Like, how do you make sure that the knowledge you come across that you don't want to lose doesn't get lost? Is there any sort of system there for that?
It's a good question. And there is. It's one of those things that kind of like the book itself, though. If I were to give one answer right now, it would probably be incorrect. But I am one of these weird people where I take notes all the time. Mm-hmm. And I do put them in common places, things like Evernote. You know, this is something I've used for years and years and years. But what I find is I actually don't reference it as much as I would imagine I would. I don't end up going back to it as much as I thought I would. I do at times. But just the act of doing that somehow allows me to retain it. And it feels like everything is occurring in these like slowly, rather than it just being a straight line. Imagine like you're taking these circles. And as you make these circles, you're kind of moving forward. This is back to my, you know, kind of silly cartoons in my head that I talk about, but I think a lot in terms of like electrical theory and electromagnetic sine wave and all that. But it's like, you know, you have these circles, and as you're making these circles, they're advancing forward. Mm. And that's what I find a lot as I return to my notes that I've made over the years, is there's these central themes that just become, like you said, crystallized. They become more and more clear as I move forward, and they become more and more me. They start off as like somebody else's idea. And if you look through my book, I mean, like the concepts in each chapter are covered so many different places, but only through kind of marinating in those ideas and making notes about them and kind of following those concentric circles forward, does it really become me, my voice, what I want to say. And it is, like you said, it's what you said it perfectly. Those steps are exactly what it is, because it ends up then in creativity at the end. Mm-hmm. At the end of all that, now it's something that is yours. Now it's all these other people who you pay homage to and who have been a part of that story, but it does become your own voice.
Yeah, it's all. I think everything is remixing. There's not much new under the sun anymore. And I can throw out a bunch of cliches here. We all stand on the shoulders of giants, et cetera, et cetera. But I really think at the end of the day is none of us are producing anything that wasn't influenced by other people. Right. Yep. And so I think it's all sort of remixing. Well, the book again is called Unconformed, An Unbound and Unbridled Path to Unstuck Growth. It currently has 28 reviews on Amazon, 27 of which are 5 stars. I am currently attempting to seek out the one person who did not leave a 5-star review so I can slap them in the face. No, I'm kidding. I don't know what that person was thinking. But anyway, good on you, Brian. I'm so excited for this book. I know you've got a couple of more in the works. So I'm curious to hear about those when the time comes. But thank you so much for being here. Thank you for writing this book, and wish you nothing but success going forward.
Thank you so much, Jeff. It's a great honor, and I really value your friendship and everything you put out in the world. So much appreciated.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Brian as much as I did. You can find out more about him, check out those links and resources we talked about, connect with Brian on social media and more at the show notes page for this episode, which is found at readtoleadpodcast.com/485 for episode 485. Remember that other website I talked about if you want to check out for free what it's like to be a member of the Read to Lead community online. It's all at jeffbrown.com/me. In a couple of weeks, I plan to welcome Kelly Thompson, who's written a book called Closing the Competence Gap. And next week's schedule includes a visit from author Paulina Marinova Pompliano and her book, Hidden Genius, The Secret Ways of Thinking That Power the World's Most Successful People. I loved this book. That's next time on the Read to Lead podcast. Well, that does it for this week. Hope to see you next time. Until then, remember, leaders read and readers lead.